Thank you, Rick, and thank you all. I love the title that someone else chose, The Living Tradition. I think that's such a perfect encapsulation of what we're all about as Unitarian Universalists. And I want to say it's something that makes me very proud to be part of our denomination. The phrase from that hymn that we just heard that sticks in my mind is, all of the people taking their place in the sun. And I think that's really at the deepest intention of the topic that we're on today. I want to give a nod to Angie. It was so lovely to see you in the Spirit of Life song there. And also to Sue, Sally, Rob, and I may be missing someone who are part of the choir in Keeping a Light that we will see. I always think it's great to see members of Lakehead Unitarian Fellowship participating in things at the national level. I think it connects us in a very nice way. And I'm very conscious of the fact of standing on the shoulders of those among us who have gone before, Bev Lehman and Jean Morrison on the board, Jean Armstrong on the board, and Ken Morrison in his work in chaplaincy. So The Living Tradition, that's the name of our book, right? That book that we hold so dear, but we, you know, they're all sitting in our special place and our hands are not on those books. And in fact, on the topic of it being a living tradition, you might have heard me talk about the desire to have more Canadian material and have it available so it could be used at places like ours and others across the country. And when Reverend Stephan Jonasson was last with us, I talked to him about that idea. And he said that he thought that that would be the last printing of the book, that it probably wouldn't be done again because there's so many different ways of sharing information that are more current and contemporary. And that, you know, once you have the book and you invest in the book, then it's fixed. So he too was thinking that we're continuing to reinvent ourselves as we go. And these new technologies help to make that possible. So as you know, we had the annual meeting a month-ish ago of the Canadian Unitarian Council. And as the president of the council, I was the chair of the meeting. So in the preparation for that, we studied up on Robert's Rule. But one thing that I missed, and it was my error, was in the bylaws, there is section number 3.3.3. And it says that at an annual meeting, there shall be dealt with, in addition to those items of business required by the Act, all other items of business that were mentioned in the notice of meeting. So in other words, we can't talk about other stuff that congregations didn't know about in advance, which of course is a good thing because that keeps the meeting on track and it recognizes the fact of what the CUC is. So the CUC is a collection of congregations. There are no individual members. There's the 35 or whatever the number is, communities like ours across the country who are the members of the CUC, and that's the CUC. So you can't bring to a meeting information or topics or whatever that the membership hasn't had a chance to consider. So there was an error made. And I want to talk about the idea of an eighth principle. And to do that, I thought I'd start with reviewing the principles themselves and giving you a little bit of history as to where they've come from. So I believe I can share my screen. Okay, Unitarian Universalist principles. So a point of introduction, and that is that through all time up until now, we've had the same set of principles in Canada as in the United States. So in 1981, the principal said, I got to move you guys around so I can see them. The principles are not dogma or doctrine, but rather a guide for those who choose to join and participate in Unitarian Universalist religious communities. So what we do is we affirm and promote. So these are not belief statements, but they're things that we affirm and promote. The inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another, and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregation. A free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience, and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. So that was what it was from 1981, carrying on for a while. And then in the 90s, people started to think that there was something very important that was missing, because we hadn't said anything at all in there about the natural world, and it was people-centric. So in 1995, an additional principle was added: respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. And there are some among us, including one I know pretty well, who feel that that really is the first principle, that without that connection and respect for the natural world, there's nothing more. So that was added in 1995. And then in the United States, as you know, race has been a huge issue in the United States really for all time. Started in 2008, the idea of having a principle that had to do with race. That conversation came to Canada in 2019, and there was a move to have the eighth principle added in 2019. And the assembly didn't seem to be ready at that time. So what was done instead was to assemble a study group called Dismantling Racism Study Group. And the co-chairs of that are Reverend Julie Stoneberg, who many of us know, and Beverly Barton, who's from Hamilton Congregation. So they've worked for 2 years. And one of the things they did was a major survey of all congregation, or of all members, like an individual survey that people could complete. And they have 800 some odd surveys from us all across the country with our views on this topic. So they looked at what was being proposed in the United States, and they amended it and shortened it so that it would fit within the structure of the principles we already have. And so that committee had 4 recommendations, and one of them was to affirm and promote individual and communal action that accountably dismantles racism and other oppressions in ourselves and our institutions. So that wasn't the only thing that they recommended, but that was one of the 4 recommendations. So I'll tell you about their other recommendations, and we'll put links in the newsletter for their report so that you can read it. It's long. There's lots of depth to it. So I have their 5 main recommendations here. One is to listen to the voices of people of color, Indigenous, and Black people. The second is to adopt the eighth principle as an explicit expression of our commitment to anti-racism as individuals and congregations. The third is a willed commitment to racial justice work, demonstrating by an investment of time and money at the congregational level, to assemble and disseminate anti-racism educational and worship materials, and to create a best practices guide for Canadian UU congregations around developing programming in this area. So those were their recommendations. So why this and why now? And these are my own thoughts about the situation we find ourselves in now and how to move forward for here. I want to say that the motion to accept the eighth principle, as it was written on the screen there, was brought forward by a person, a member from Victoria, I think she was, and it was seconded and discussed. Then it was ruled as out of order because of Robert's rule said that it hadn't, prior notice wasn't given. And the parliamentarian was consulted about what to do now, and he came up with a rule, and Robert says that says we can overturn the regular rules, the standing orders. And that requires a 66% motion, or 66% of the people have to vote in favor of that. And they did. And with that done, we called the question again, and a large majority of people voted in favor of it. Those who didn't vote in favor and spoke against had various thoughts about that, the main one being a problem of process, in that there wasn't time for congregations to discuss this, and it really is a matter that needs to come up from the grassroots of the movement, and everybody needs to be on board. So why is this an important thing to be considering right now? So I call to mind some recent events, one of which Brenda spoke about this morning, about discovering bodies of so many children at a residential school in Kamloops. Another is, we just passed the first anniversary of the highly publicized death of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of the police. We know that around the world, there's higher incidence of COVID cases and COVID deaths among racialized people, and that applies to Canada, the United States, and the world. And we really are seeing through this the interconnected nature of the world. What affects one affects us all. Some would say that the principles that we have, you know, affirm the worth and dignity of every person. And I guess the question is, well, how well is that working? And do we need to draw attention, larger focus of attention on this topic now, because the way we've been going at it so far hasn't accomplished the goal? Julie Stoneberg had a great metaphor that I want to share with you about why this is important now. She talked about fire departments. And of course, fire departments are concerned about all phones. But the ones that they pay attention to and where they spray the water are the ones that are on fire. So in other words, drawing attention to the places where the problems are so that the problem can be solved, and that we would ultimately get to a place where we don't need to pay this special attention because we've achieved that place of inherent worth and dignity of all persons. Some of you may have attended the event held in Thunder Bay virtually this year to mark the International Day for Ending Racism and Discrimination on March 21st. It's usually, or for the last decade or so, a big breakfast at the Victoria Inn with 500-ish people. And an important day where we as a community say, we need to work together and we want to work together to end racism and discrimination. So this year's speaker was Jesse Wente. You may have heard him on CBC Radio. He did tech column and all kinds of other things. He's been a broadcaster for a long time. And he's now the first Indigenous chair of the Canada Council for the Arts. So he spoke, and he talked about where to go from here in terms of relations with Indigenous people. And his advice was this. He says, it's going to take a long time, but keep doing it and build relationships. And this is the phrase that really struck me, as he said, reduce harm. Reduce harm. And then bring a sovereignty lens to the situation. So I think the whole idea of figuring out how we can reduce harm is really important. And I think shining a light on the topic can help in the reducing of harm. So next steps from the CUC is in a week or two, a package will come out that will outline a process that will carry on between now and a special meeting at the end of November. Obviously, what the action that we took at the annual meeting in May is null and void because it was outside of what the bylaws allow us to do. So we have a procedural problem to fix, and we have the need for congregations to engage in the conversation and in the work. And so this package will outline what to do between now and then. And there'll be a chance for congregations to react to a proposal, and then that reaction may further shape the proposal. And then the special meeting as part of the regional fall gathering, which will be at the end of November. Other work is going on at the same time. So you'll recall the work that we did on truth, healing, and reconciliation, and Sally and David led us through a process on that, and there's various film series and other things going on. Similar work is being undertaken in the dismantling racism and other oppression area. One of the programs is called Widening the Circle, and this is something that was developed in the States and is being adapted for use in Canada. You know, more Canadian examples and whatever, and broadening the context from probably more of a Black situation in the States to having more Indigenous content for Canada. So that will be available in the fall as a kind of training learning program. There's some thought about whether a program should be developed that's similar to the Welcoming Congregations program, which was a study program that many congregations did. Our congregation's done it twice, that had to do with sexual diversity. And so that this would deal with racial diversity and other oppressions. And so that there would be learning steps for congregations to take and programming that we could be part of. Because the people who are in the study group are very clear that, yes, the principle is one thing, but let's not focus all of our energy on the principle, because that's just some words. It's what are the actions that we are going to take to accountably dismantle racism. So there we go. From where I sit, that's a kind of an overview of the situation. And I'm kind of close to it, so I may have missed some things that would be helpful in your understanding. And I'd be happy to have a conversation, questions or comments that people have. Brenda.
Thank you so much, Margaret. And I think I have to say that I'm so impressed with how you and Vita and the group have handled this. You admitted, oops, we missed the bylaw part. And so I think it's time to move on. Like, it's such an emotional time. I heard the lady speak yesterday who had the experience with her adopted Black son, I guess. Or I don't know, is that proper language? I don't even know anymore what language to use, and how heart-wrenching this all is. So I'm hoping we can move past the mistake and move on to the action of how do we address this. And one of the things I'm wondering from the CUCX perspective is, do we have people of color, Indigenous leaders who can help us with the decision-making and as to how we can move forward? Like, I hate to see a group of white settlers making these kinds of decisions without the input from the groups that are most affected. And like we know at LUF, we have very limited, and we've absorbed them into our culture, into our understanding. So how do we reverse that without their input? How can we do that? I'd like to get it, and have you had any thoughts on that? Thank you.
I think that is really important. The study group is still in place because their mandate was to do their report, make their recommendations, and then continue to work with the implementation process. So they will help. So Beverly Horton is Black. I don't know all the ethnicities of all the members of the group, but the group was put together to have representative ethnicities. So there are a number of Black people on that. Interestingly enough, Michael Scales, who represents the BC region and is at North Shore in New Westminster, he's been on the board for 3 years, he's Black. The new minister on board is Shauna Lingood, Reverend Shauna Lingood. She's the co-minister from Victoria, and she's Black. Vita herself is a person of color. She's Chinese Malaysian. So we will hear all those other voices, because you're right. Middle-aged white people of privilege talking about this is not the whole picture. We really have to hear the voices. And certainly that was the first recommendation of the group, was to listen to the voices. I think so far, we have the dismantling racism in one place and the truth, healing, and reconciliation work, which is originally based in another place. And I don't know if they're going to come together. There's some voices that would suggest that the Indigenous work is separate and different. So how we have a fulsome conversation with everybody, I'm not sure. But I definitely agree that it's very important that we hear all the voices.
Thank you. I'm hoping that we can address the Indigenous issue here in Thunder Bay by including them. And I don't know how to do that. So something for the board to think about.
I think a reality of our country is that this issue plays out differently in different places. So in Toronto, the visible piece is Black. In Thunder Bay, it's Indigenous. And across Western Canada, it's Indigenous. So I think for those of you who listen to the Confluence lecture that Reverend Ann Barker did, she's the minister at Westwood in Edmonton, what she said, and sometimes these little short phrases, they stick with you, and what she said is deal with what's in front of you. And so I think for us in Thunder Bay, it's paying attention around Indigenous issues. David.
I just want to let everyone know that both the Way Forward process and the Dismantling Racism Study Group report are available on our website on the homepage under News and Events. And so that if people want to get started on doing this work, it's easily available right on our website.
Thank you, David. That's great. I should just mention that our delegate at the meeting was Sandra McIver. And she said when I talked about this the day after that she had voted in favor of the motion because she felt it was time and that this issue needed attention. So I thought I'd let you know that. And I think she'd be quite all right with me saying that here. Christine.
I'm having computer trouble. Anyway, I have a question about the principle itself, the language. Is there going to be any effort to make it shorter? This is the longest bullet to be added to our covenant to affirm and promote. And I'm wondering if there are wordsmiths in the congregation that could make this much shorter, more efficient, and more powerful. Thank you.
Good point. Good point. I mentioned that it had been shortened from what the American version is. The American version goes on about beloved community, and I'm not sure what all else, but beloved community is part of that. And I think we are better off with something that aligns more smoothly with what we have, but the use of the word accountably in there feels awkward to me. I don't know if it's even grammatically right. Accountably dismantle. I don't know what that is exactly. But that's a good point.
Oh, this is not good. Thank you.
Thank you. Sue.
Okay. I'll watch. Sorry about that delay. I think it's a wonderful effort for Unitarians to be making across North America. Ultimately, you know, we are admittedly a predominantly white organization, but we need to remember that the remedy falls with the settlers. And falls with us, the white community that has enslaved and tried to eradicate the Indigenous people who were here when we came and enslaved people from Africa in order to become such a world leader that we are. And one, I've been doing a fair amount of reading over the past year, and I think it is upon us to look at the policies and practices that we have in our community as Euro-Americans to try to make the necessary changes in our institutional situations so that we can empower those that we have been working, that our systems have been working for decades and in fact centuries to make lopsided. And in equalizing that stuff, it's going to take some institutional and policy work that really, well, absolutely, we need to be working with the indigenous neighbors and the immigrants and others, people of color. We certainly, as Unitarians, I think we're in a good position to take leadership roles in evaluating what kinds of institutional and policy changes have to be made to equalize, to turn things around. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for bringing all of this story to us. I actually am very proud of the fact that that the CUC has embraced this subject and at the same time made certain, insisted on making certain that all the congregations are fully aware of the change before it goes into place so that the whole country can welcome the new principle as belonging to all of us.
Thank you. I would note that in the United States, in the UUA, a couple things are different than our situation here. One is that the principles are contained in the bylaws of the UUA, and in order for the principles to change, it's a bylaw change that's required, whereas ours are not. But I imagine we will do some bylaw review, and I wouldn't be surprised if putting them into the bylaws is something that we'll consider doing as part of that bylaw change. And I would also note that the UUA is not ready to vote on this as a corporate body, but many churches have in the states have voted in favor of it. And so far, I believe the number is 63 churches. Now, that's the numerator. I don't know what the denominator is. Maybe Sue, you do know how many Unitarian churches there are in the state. And I wonder if Duluth is having this conversation and if you had anything to add about what's happening in the states or in Minnesota on this.
Duluth has a racial justice group that has been focusing on book discussions and has shared information about the eighth principle with the congregation, but the congregation has not done holistic work to dig into it and vote. I don't believe our congregation has not cast a vote as to whether or not to support the eighth principle, and I think that's where the congregational work needs to go. And we don't have time to do that either.
Do you have any idea how many churches there are in the state?
Oh no, I would have to look it up. But
okay,
certainly hundreds.
Okay. Yeah, I was guessing at 400 or 500, but I don't know if that's right. Thank you. It's interesting to hear from different places how this is going. I know in some congregations across Canada, some are having votes on this now. Some are having votes at their annual meetings that are upcoming. So different congregations are approaching it differently. Other questions? Michelle.
I'd like to follow up on Sue's comment about us looking at our policies and practices, kind of our systemic ones, and that a place to maybe explore would be how do we get the feedback of these marginalized or disenfranchised communities? As you know, many of you, I've been involved in an international board. And for the whole time that I've been on that board, until just a year ago, actually, we've had an Indigenous woman on the board. And towards the end, when we were reflecting together, I had a really powerful conversation with her. And one of the things that she said was that she never really felt like she was very involved in ceremony and stuff like that. And in all our annual gatherings, which brought together, you know, let's say 60 to 70 women, she would be at the center of the ceremony and the ritual. But she said to me that she never really felt like her perspective was heard. Like it wasn't okay for her to show up as an Indigenous woman. As long as she sort of fit in, you know, and Sue, I think you sort of spoke to that. Kind of trying to fit in and sort of adjust herself to meet the white perspective, that was good, that she was accepted there. But to come up with her own very unique perspective on things, there was a real challenge from her view, for the organization didn't really know how to grapple with that. And I think that's one of the big challenges. My experience right now on the board, the international board, is I'm bringing up a diverse perspective, and the organization doesn't really know what to do with a unique voice, someone who expresses something that's not the status quo. How, you know, we say we want to listen deeply, but in fact, how do we do that? And how do we show that we are in fact listening deeply? So I just think this is a very challenging area, and obviously a very important one for us to explore. And I think, yes, we need to do it in concert with people from other than white communities to get the full picture. And we need to be prepared to really listen deeply until they feel that they've been heard. And they, you know, they have the right to keep checking in with us. Are you really hearing what I'm saying? Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. I think that's a very good comment. I think most often people vote with their feet, right? And we just don't see them anymore. I think that's the most common thing that happens. For any of you who were at the Confluence lecture at the conference a few weeks ago, there was a woman there who is the Director of Religious Exploration at Reverend Ann Barker's Church Westwood in Edmonton. And she says that she almost never feels comfortable. She did feel comfortable in that situation. She describes herself as disabled and queer. And she said she almost never feels comfortable in groups of people because one of her specialities is always seems to be not considered. And so how do we create spaces that that work for people is a really big question. And I think a good exploration for us. Well, here we go. There are about 1,000 congregations in the UUA. That's a lot, wow. So 63 have signed on to the principle and apparently 15 within the last few weeks. So I think it's gaining momentum in the States now.